I'm Bob Andelman, and this is a Mr. Media interview. On today's show, I'll talk to Mark Guggenheim, writer of comic books such as Arrow, The Infinite Adventures of Jonas Quantum, Stringers, and The Rocketeer at War. Wait, you know, it seems like I'm forgetting something. Oh, duh. His day job! He's the showrunner for Arrow and DC's Legends of Tomorrow. And he married well, too. His wife, Tara Butters, is co-showrunner for Marvel's Agent Carter. Stick around. Mark Guggenheim dreams in four-color swellness.
Nice. Very good.
Mark Guggenheim is one of those onion guys, where every time you peel back a layer, two more costume characters appear in its place. A year ago, when he first appeared on Mr. Media, we spent most of our time talking about his first novel, the out-of-control shadow government story of Overwatch. That, and a bit about his day job as writer and producer of the CW's hit show Arrow, which had just spun off The Flash. Today, this guy has got superheroes coming out of his eyes, ears, and everywhere else. Guggenheim is now the showrunner for Arrow, in its fourth season, and its upcoming spin-off, DC's Legends of Tomorrow, which will bring together the Atom, Firestorm, Hawkman, Hawkgirl, Captain Cold, Heatwave, Rip Hunter, White Canary, and more. He's also the guy that raised Constantine from last season's ashes and made millions wonder what the NBC show could have been if it had come from his keyboard. But TV represents just a fraction of the characters in his sandbox. He's also found time to write a rack's worth of new comics this year, including Arrow 2.5 for DC, The Infinite Adventures of Jonas Quantum for Legendary, Stringers for Oni Press, and, my favorite, The Rocketeer at War for IDW. Earlier this year, he also wrote a Squadron Sinister series for Marvel. And when he goes home, he can't escape the superhero business. Wife Tara Butters is co-showrunner of Marvel's Agent Carter on ABC. Oh, and he is an indefatigable sharer on Twitter, Facebook, and Tumblr. Mark Guggenheim, welcome back to Mr. Media.
Thanks for coming. Thanks for inviting me.
Always good to see you. Appreciate when you accept the invitations. That's the best part.
Oh, well, I appreciate when I'm able to actually have the time to do so.
Well, and that's what I want to ask you. When and how do you sleep? Is all this an illusion? I mean, do you have hamsters in the other room running and writing at the same time? What's the deal?
God, I wish. You know, I get asked that question a lot because I do admit I write quite a bit. But, you know, there's really no magic to it. I do sleep, probably not as much as I would like. I do see my kids, certainly not as much as they would like. I do see my wife, probably not as much as she would like. But, you know, I guess my answer to that question, because I do get it a lot, is sort of twofold. One, I am a fast writer. I've always been very, very fast. I think it comes from being an attorney and having to, you know, write briefs constantly, and, you know, doing a 50-page brief in a night isn't unheard of, and you learn how to get your ideas out there pretty fast. And the other piece of it is that I am what I would describe as ruthlessly efficient. I really try to avoid a lot of, you know, bullshitting in the middle of the day. You know, a lot of the Tumblr and actually a lot of the Twitter posts you read of mine are all, you know, scheduled out, you know, via TweetDeck. You know, I just try to go through my day. You know, I wake up at 5 a.m. I'll do some writing before the kids wake up. I'll get the kids off to school, go back to some more writing, head into the office, you know, put the kids to bed, do some more writing, go to bed. So I'm writing pretty constantly. But the way I achieve it all is by being just very efficient with my time.
It occurred to me, as someone who's got 30 years of journalism behind him, that there are certain professions where you learn to be very good with your time. I mean, you can't write daily newspaper stories unless you are fast and efficient. And a lawyer learns that as well. You know, especially when you're dealing in billable hours, you want to be productive, right?
Well, that's exactly it. It's like, you know, if you're billing, you know, 80 to 90 hours a week, that's not being at the office 80 to 90 hours a week. That's actual billable time. And one thing that I learned very early on was, you know, that time hanging around the coffee pot, chit-chatting with with coworkers, while nice and who doesn't like the social interaction, I'm not being able to bill that time to anyone, and that's just extending my workday, which is already very long. So I guess the best way to describe me is antisocial but efficient.
But still well liked, apparently.
I knock on wood. I think kind of for the most part, yes.
And is part of it, you do a lot of creator-owned stuff, and we're going to get into that more specifically. Creator-owned stuff, you've created, last year we talked about Overwatch, the novel. In television, of course, you never know when you're going to be out of work the next day.
Right.
You guys are riding high at the moment with Greg Berlanti. There's four shows, basically, that have some interconnection.
Yeah.
And Greg's got other shows. Blind Spot's already picked up for a full second season. Crazy shit.
Yeah,
you know?
It's crazy.
I mean, it's just nuts. You are creating other things. Is part of the idea for you to have other projects? I mean, I'm sure you're very busy with the two shows right now, and you know, Arrow seems to, it's going to go several more seasons, no doubt. Hopefully, Legends will go a couple, many seasons. But you don't know, and you know. Things change. So is part of what you're doing creating product so that, you know, you continue to have, or is it just you keeping busy?
No, I think it's me keeping busy. It's me always trying to carve out a little bit of a space in my workload and in my time as being pure. My collaboration with Greg, but it's also important for me to develop an identity as a writer, you know, separate and apart from him. And also, you know, I love it to give early on would have become a comic book writer first. Hey, Bob, are you still there?
Yeah, I was just going to say.
Okay.
Yeah, we kind of came and went a little bit.
Yeah.
Resolved? I think it's resolved.
Okay. I would say let me know if I fritz out, but if I fritz out, you probably won't be able to tell me. At any rate, you'll edit stuff to make this all work.
I will now.
okay, there you go. I love comic books, and I've always, you know, I think I probably would have become a comic book writer first if that path had been offered to me. So I love, you know, I do it really for the love of the game, and you know, it's worthwhile. I will say that, you know, people are always asking me, how do you do so many things? Well, like Stringers was actually written back during the first season of Arrow, which I was plenty busy on, but it wasn't like I was writing Stringers and Jonas Quantum and, you know, the Marvel books I've been working on. So, you know, a lot of people sometimes tend to confuse publication date with actual writing dates. And sometimes there's a pretty big lead time, and other times it's more compressed. It really depends.
Well, and I want to ask you about that, because the original opportunity to do this interview was to talk about Jonas Quantum. Since then, Stringers has appeared.
Yep.
I also went back to the comic store and caught up on Arrow 2.5.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you. I was particularly enamored to hear that you were doing The Rocketeer at War. You were just explaining how this stuff, it spreads out more.
It definitely spreads out more. I'm not writing, you know, multiple comics in a given week. I wish I could say that there's a set schedule, like, oh, this week I work on this project, this week. It's really always, for me, comic book writing is always about keeping the artists working. So depending upon the speed of the artist I'm working on, that will dictate which script I work on, you know, that given week, because if the artists shut down, then nothing's happening. It's the exact same thing with television. It's like you always are writing to whatever, you know, production and whatever prep date, you know, the beast needs to be fed. So it's just a matter of feeding the right beast at the right time.
And well, let's talk about Jonas Quantum. And interesting. I'm glad you mentioned the artist. Freddie Williams III has been on the show.
Yeah.
He came on and talked about his book of a couple years ago about doing digital.
Yeah, comics. I have that book on my bookshelf.
There you go. Jonas is kind of a modern Doc Savage. I mean, he's prepared for every situation, and he's almost never caught by surprise. Is he a little too perfect?
You know, it's funny. People ask me that question, and I like to let the audience or the readership decide that for themselves. I will say that, you know, he suffers from the same problem I think a lot of hyper-intelligent people suffer from, which is how do you interact, you know, with people dumber than you, you know, and how do you form those human, you know, he has a really difficult time forming human connections because his life is so unusual and his intellect is so unusual and thus his circumstances are so unusual. So it's like, how does he bring himself down essentially to earth to converse with us mere mortals and in doing so create a human connection? So that's his, you know, that's his real kryptonite.
It was Doc Savage, was that a fair?
Yeah, actually, like I feel like there's a substrata of genre characters, the Doc Savages, the Indiana Jones, the James Bonds, even the Flash Gordons. You know, the leading man who's not a superhero per se, doesn't wear a costume, you know, doesn't have a secret identity, but is an adventurer. And I was definitely, you know, swimming in those waters as I was thinking about this character, and trying to work him up. And I feel like we've gotten away from the Doc Savages and the Indiana Jones and the James Bonds. It's been a long time since I've seen a character like that, and that's one of the primary motivations behind creating this character. Was I was really just thinking about, wow, it's been a long time since I've seen a character in that vein before, and you know, I was sort of hungering for one, and in the absence of someone providing one, I decided to write one myself.
There was a movie this past year that also came to mind, Kingsman.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Those characters, I can't remember the actor who played the lead, who was training the younger ones, but he always seemed a bit Jonas Quantum-like in that he was always prepared. He always knew what was coming. Of course, that wound up doing him in, I guess, too.
Yeah, way to spoil the movie for people who haven't seen it. You know, I think that there is definitely a similarity there. I think Kingsman certainly draws probably more, you know, intentionally from James Bond.
Sure.
But absolutely. And it's always tricky to, like, have a character who always seems to be able to pull the right thing out of their ass at the right time. There are some... you know, I think there's other types of stories to tell. You know, there's different. Sometimes you'll do a story where it's all about the plot twists, and other times it's all about the setbacks that the protagonist has. You know, with Jonas, I'm sort of experimenting. I'm trying to play a little bit more in an intellectual space. I'm really trying to make the book interesting because of its ideas as opposed to its plot turns, which is a different way of approaching a story for me. The book itself is a little bit of an experiment, both for the readers and I think and for me as a writer. I wanted to, you know, try something very, very different. And I sort of designed the book to force me to do a different kind of story each week or each month because the book is not serialized. Each issue is self-contained. I'm always starting from ground zero. I'm always starting from scratch. And I have challenged myself to make each issue different from the one that came before it. So that's, again, it's a book whose fuel is, instead of it being fueled by plot, it's fueled by ideas.
By the way, I want to correct myself. Freddie Williams the second, not Freddie Williams the third.
You know, I that did jump out of me, but I'm like, I'm off. I go.
No. Feel free to correct me at any time. I'm sure there'll be many opportunities. But okay. Yeah, I have it in front of me, and I looked and went, oh man, why did I say third? So the book is called The Infinite Adventures of Jonas Quantum. But what we often find with the smaller publishers, not necessarily smaller, but a Dark Horse or Legendary, is that these tend to be limited series. Is there a limit on the number that you've committed to, or is it indefinite?
It's indefinite. We, you know, because of my schedule and Freddie's schedule, we sort of are planning it out in chunks. So the first chunk is, I can't call it a volume because it's not serialized. So, you know, I just think of it as a chunk. That chunk is six issues. And then we'll, you know, and we're still, Freddie's still drawing the sixth issue right now. So then once he finishes that and we look at our respective schedules, we'll, you know, start planning the next chunk.
I saw a lot of talk just this week about how Marvel had relaunched with number ones, and there someone suggested that DC go and do that next because it seems to be people are happy to start over with number one all over again just to get them. So my question is, where I'm going with this is, you're planning six. Will you go to whenever you get to the next one? Will it be seven? Will you start a new series number? How will you do that?
I don't know. It's a great question. I mean, at the end of the day, that's probably up to Legendary. One thought that did occur to me was to just change the title. Like, instead of it being The Infinite Adventures of Jonas Quantum, it would be The Amazing Adventures of Jonas Quantum. You know, and sort of a little bit of a nod to the Indiana Jones movies of just tweaking the title. But that was, you know, we'll see. It'll, you know, that as I like to say, that's future me's problem.
All right. How do you and Freddie work together on the book? What's the...
You know, it's very collaborative. It's actually a lot more collaborative than a lot of my other comic book work. You know, basically what I'll do is I do write full script, but and I say this with all the artists I work with. I write full script because I got to write something, and you know, they should feel free to, you know, change things however they want. And you know, I will call out, you know, I go panel by panel, and I'll call out specific shots if they occur to me. Like, I'm sort of, you know, the script is basically my best representation of what's in my head. And I always explain to the artist that what's in my head is not necessarily right or certainly not the final word on things. So if they have a way to tell the story better, then they should go off and do that. And I'll re-script to what they draw. You know, I want them to have complete reign to change things around. And Freddie is one of those rare artists who's really taken me up on it. And you know, I mean, it's not like I get the art back and it's a completely different story, but, you know, he'll, you know, combine panels, he'll extend sequences, he'll move things over to other pages. You know, he's really great. And it's actually wonderful to work with an artist like that because you sort of see that, oh, they're you know, Freddie's really bringing his own sensibility and his own creativity to the process, which is really great. I you know, much prefer that than working with an artist who just is going to execute exactly, you know, what I wrote down, because I'm not an artist. You know, I like to think of myself as a visual person. I work in visual mediums and I think in visual terms. But the truth of the matter is that, you know, I always say I would rather the artist execute their vision perfectly than my vision, unsatisfactorily. You know, and they are in a much better position than I am, for obvious reasons, to determine what they think they can pull off.
Now, I was curious, because of the number of series that you have kind of breaking all one after the other almost simultaneously, if you were doing full scripts or if you were doing the old Stan Lee Marvel way of, you know, giving the artist, here's a breakdown of what it's about, you go fill it in and I'll put in the dialogue later.
You know, I've been very lucky. I've been writing comic books for over 10 years now, and I always have worked in full script. And then when I partnered up with Dave Bullock on the Rocketeer at War series, Dave wanted to be far more involved in the process. And he basically wanted to, like, co-plot it with me. And, you know, it was suggested, would we work Marvel method? And I was terrified, completely terrified, because I had never done it, and I wasn't sure I could do it. And I Scott Dunbier, the editor, I'm like, okay, you know, I'll, that's fine, but you got to give me a lot of time because I don't know how. I mean, this is a completely different way of writing comic books for me, and I don't know if I'm going to be able to pull it off. And I have to say, I actually started last week the scripting process. You know, I basically sent Dave a page by page plot that he then altered and accentuated and you know, did his thing to, and then drew pages according to it. I got those pages back, and then it was like, okay, now it's time to actually script it, this thing I've never done before. And I sat down, and I have to say, it was much easier than I expected. And the result is very different because, you know, I write sort of very bantery kind of dialogue for the most part. That's really,
I
mean, that's
noticed
like,
that, really.
Yeah. I mean, it's very, very true. Joe's Quantum. Joe's Quantum, it's like to the nth degree.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
And what is interesting about working Marvel style is you really can't do that. I mean, because you've got the art and you've got to, you have to, if you've got a panel with two people in it, person A and person B, you're basically being told by the artist, well, person A has to speak first if he's on the left side of the panel. Hang on one second, Bob. You're going to have
sure.
to do a little edit on this.
Okay.
Sorry, I'm doing a video interview. Oh, it's okay. Everything okay?
Yeah, it's fine.
Okay, I'll come find you.
Okay.
Sorry, you'll...
No spoilers, unfortunately, so maybe we'll leave it in.
You'll do so... Okay, all good. Well, anyway, it's not up to me to decide who speaks first in this panel or in this scene. The artist has basically determined that just by their layout. So I was very nervous, but it turned out to be, so far, knock on wood, it's been a relatively easy process and a much faster process, I will say. It definitely... I think when all is said and done, particularly once I find my rhythm with the scripting, I will have basically been, you know, the total amount of time I take to do the first issue Marvel style will probably be a lot less than if I wrote it full script.
So you could probably see where Stan and Roy Thomas particularly did it that way and were able to produce so much because...
Oh, totally. Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely, it's very economical. I would say it's very different, and I wouldn't. It's not like I'm going to suddenly switch over and go Marvel method. But what I like is it's another tool in my toolbox, and I think for something like Rocketeer at War, which is sort of very intentionally old fashioned and supposed to have a nostalgic feel to it, that Marvel style really benefits it. I wouldn't do it with Jonas Quantum because Jonas Quantum is a very sort of, you know, in addition to hopefully channeling a little Warren Ellis, a little Grant Morrison, I'm trying to channel a little Aaron Sorkin and Brian Bendis. And that, you know, approach doesn't really lend itself to the Marvel style. So, but I like having another tool in my toolbox. It'll be interesting going forward. To experiment that with in other series.
Well, so this is kind of a surprise to me. I kind of wondered if maybe when you've done Marvel series like Squadron Sinister earlier this year, if you had worked in that way. But obviously, you didn't till now.
No, never. And always a little too afraid to do it. But I'm so glad I took the plunge. I really am.
Well, let's go ahead and since you were referring to Rocketeer, let's talk about that a little bit. I'm a huge Rocketeer fan.
Cool, me too.
I've got the movie. I was trying to find. I had backed up the toys behind me recently, and I'm trying to decide what to put back. I couldn't find my Rocketeer. I'm so frustrated.
Oh.
I don't have my Rocketeer, but love that. Love the comics. Love Dave Stevens.
Me too.
Betty Page, and you know all that kind of stuff. What will you be doing? It's the Rocketeer at War with an exclamation point, I believe.
Yeah.
Where are you going with this?
Well, I tell you, this, I have to say, is it's one of the cooler ideas I've ever been presented with. And I would love to take credit for it because I think, you know, obviously Rocketeer has been published, you know, for a great number of years. A lot of, you know, great comic book writers and artists have worked on the character. They've always been very faithful, I think, to what Dave Stevens had created. Which is wonderful because what he created was so, I think, visceral and you know, appealing. But there was never any sort of changing with the formula. And Scott Dunbier came to me with this idea of basically the Rocketeer adventures set during World War II, which to me was like the perfect remix because it plays with the franchise in a way that I think, you know, the franchise really could benefit from. But at the same time, because it's set in that era, it still can feel nostalgic and it can still feel like the 1930 serials that it was inspired by. And it still feels like the Rocketeer. Everything you love about the Rocketeer is present in this concept. It's just, in a different environment, which, you know, very few ideas, I think, really strike that perfect balance. And I was immediately in. The second he told me, you know, Rocketeer during World War II, that was it for me. And it's been a great deal of fun to work on, because you do get a chance to play with expectations. You know, I think the cold open of the book, which I don't want to ruin, is one of the more... Actually, I'll ruin it. It's I kill the Rocketeer in the opening pages.
Damn you, Mark Guggenheim!
You know, but it's so much fun. And it's the type of thing that, you know, you can't do if you were doing a traditional Rocketeer story, obviously. But lots of fun, and it's been a joy working with Dave, who, you know, he brings such a Darwin Cook style and sensibility. Again, it fits in with the character, it fits in with the time. We've got all these different cool little bonus features that really make you feel like it's steeped in World War II. It's awesome. I mean, it's a really fun book. I think people are going to really like it.
You're this multimedia guy with his hand in all kinds of media. Do you think we will ever get another shot at either a Rocketeer movie or maybe a Rocketeer series of some sort?
That's a great question. I think, you know, I don't see why not. You know, I will say, and I can speak from some experience with, you know, given my wife is working on a period TV show right now, I think period TV shows are oftentimes, at least period adventure shows, are a hard sell with, you know, network audiences these days. But maybe, I don't know, cable streaming, who knows? I'd love to see another Rocketeer movie. You know, that would be terrific. I thought the first Rocketeer movie was, for the longest time, like the reigning heavyweight champ in terms of superhero movies at the time. And I think one of the all-time greatest superhero movies. You know, so anything is possible. I would love to see that. I don't know. I don't know who controls the rights and all that stuff, but that would be awesome.
Yeah, that would be good. All right, let's continue, because you've got so much stuff going on. Stringers. I read that it's similar to Nighthawk.
Nightcrawler.
Nightcrawler. I'm sorry. Yeah, Nighthawk. Marvel. Nightcrawler. You had written this before that ever came out.
Yeah, I mean, I did, and I swear I did. But you know, it's funny. I will, in describing the book, I will reference Nightcrawler just out of pure laziness. It's easier to do that than it is to go into a whole big thing about the way video stringers in Los Angeles operate. But it has about as much, you know, I want to say it has as much to do with Nightcrawler as, you know, Raiders of the Lost Ark and Schindler's List had to do with each other. They were both directed by Steven Spielberg, and they both had to deal with Nazis, but that's about as, you know, the tonal difference is fairly significant. You know, Nightcrawler is a very, I think, you know, serious and super dark look at this profession, and I'll just quickly go into the profession for people who haven't read Stringers or seen Nightcrawler. Basically, you know, in Los Angeles, and this is true for a lot of the major markets, but it's very big in Los Angeles, you know, the nightly news gets a lot of, and the morning news shows, they get a lot of their currency from, you know, car chases and, you know, crime aftermaths and fires, and, you know, it's all these, you know, it's basically, it's the, you know, it's the video equivalent of the old newspaper thing of we need good art for the front page. This video material is basically compiled not by people who work for the various news organizations, but rather by freelancers, by stringers, who run around. They listen on their, you know, they got CB radios, they listen to the 911 frequencies and everything, and they go out and they try to get pictures of that car chase, pictures of that shootout, et cetera, et cetera. And I had found out about this a number of years ago. NPR had done a piece called Video Nightcrawlers. They had done a piece called Video Nightcrawlers, and I'm like, oh, wow, that's a great world to set a story in. And obviously, you know, obviously the guys who did Nightcrawler, I'm completely blanking on their writer director's name, which is terrible. It'll come to me. Had heard about this world and saw a very different kind of story, a really dark, wonderful story. Nightcrawler is terrific. I absolutely love it. I just had a different idea, which was I wanted to do something that was kind of, you know, rollicking, fun, you know, like a comedy thriller set in this high octane world. And I also wanted to do something that was in the vein of Collateral or Go, these movies, you know, sort of set in Los Angeles that all take place in one night. The idea of like one night in Los Angeles seen through the eyes of these video stringers, it was just very interesting to me. And you know, this, I have to say, of all my comic book projects, this one has been one of the most satisfying I've ever had, because it's, you know, Justin Greenwood has turned in such an amazing, amazing job on the art. It's got this, it has such a point of view. You know, when you pick up a copy of Stringers, right now we're publishing it in, you know, in monthly floppies, but we're eventually going to collect it into a really gorgeous trade paperback. You know, and because it was originally written as a graphic novel, but for scheduling reasons, we separated it out. But when it's all collected, we're going to remove the chapter breaks, and it'll just read like one big long story, sort of as it was designed to be. And it just has such a point of view. It doesn't, you know, it feels like an indie comic book, and it you can almost taste the, you know, the smoke and the grit under the fingernails and everything. It's a great deal of fun, and it's a different world than you typically see represented in comic books, which I'm very proud about. It's also just, you know, reviews are a dangerous thing, but it's gotten me some of the best comic book reviews I've ever gotten in my career. So there's that.
Very nice. Yeah. Now, I know that people are like jonesing for us to talk about this other thing that you work on, so I want to ease into it, but I want to talk about the Arrow 2.5 comic for DC.
Yeah, thank you.
Kind of go from there. The comic was rated T for teens, as they say about the video games, and no wonder. I mean, the 12th issue, for example, page 3, we jump to this bedroom scene, which kind of blew my mind. I don't want to give away too much. Okay, what the hell, I will. Sarah Lance and her lover Nyssa are not just kissing, which 10 years ago would have been shocking. They are entangled in the nude, in bed. Their arms, legs, akimbo, they're all, you know. That was pretty hot stuff. That I got to ask you, could you have gotten away with that on the CW?
Oh, probably.
Really?
Yeah, I would think so. I mean, We've done that. Yeah, I would think so. I mean, we've done that with, you know, a man and a woman, and I think the CW is more liberal than most. I think we could.
I mean, there was a pretty hot Olicity scene at the end of last season.
Yeah, exactly. So I think
don't get me wrong, I'm not offended at all. I thought it was great, but I thought, wow, this was, you know.
One of the things, you know, that's just a reality of the show, is that Nyssa and Sarah, the two characters in the scene you're describing, are lovers on the show. And, you know, spoiler alert for people who, you know, haven't seen season 3 of Arrow, but in season 3 of Arrow, Sarah dies.
What?
I know. And by the way, spoiler alert, in season 4 of Arrow, she comes back to life. So.
My wife thanks you for that, by the way.
I'm here to help you. Look, we love Katie Lotz and we love the character of Sarah Lance. You know, it was something we were always planning on doing. But, you know, one of the things that we always try to do on Arrow is we try to, you know, have a large ensemble of a lot of different, you know, races and religions and sexual orientations. And one of the things that I wanted to do was give Sarah a proper goodbye with Nyssa, because the nature of the comic book, I mean, the nature of the show, it was such that because of the time jump and the when we killed off Sarah, we didn't have the chance to show that final moment, the last time these two lovers were together. And that's one of the many opportunities the comic book afforded me, was to, I could tell that story. I could tell that piece of their love story.
Well, and I have to point out that their love story is handled as casually and incidentally as Oliver and Felicity, for example. It's just, this is just, you know, this is who they found, and this is who they love, and this is who Oliver, you know, I mean.
I think that's, honestly, I feel like that's the only way it should be. I feel like, you know, it's 2015, you know, and I'm so glad we're now, quite frankly, in an era where, you know, where when you have a gay character on, you know, on a show, when you have an interracial couple on the show, you name it, it's not a big deal. It is just normal. And I have a lot of conflicted feelings about network television and how conservative, quite frankly, it's gotten. There's a lot of TV that I grew up with and hold very dear to me. L.A. Law, Picket Fences, Wise Guy, St. Elsewhere, Hill Street Blues. All of these shows had episodes that you could never do on television today. So in many ways, I feel like we've really gone very far backwards in network television. The one area where we've actually made some growth is, yes, big deal, Diggle and Lila are married. Who cares? You know, yes,
no, good point.
Sarah's a bisexual. Who cares? And I feel like that's, you know, that's where we've actually made some progress. So, you know, there's that.
You know, I'm just thinking about it. Have you established that Sarah's dad knows that she's bisexual? Has that actually been dealt with on screen?
Yeah, it has, because she had told him. There's a scene in, I believe it's episode 205, where they're having tea, and he knows that Nyssa is in love with Sarah and vice versa, and he's very supportive. You know, we really tried to, in writing that scene, we tried to give Lance as realistic a reaction as we could. It, not because he's a cop and he's quote-unquote conservative or old school, even though that's certainly the way we write him. It was more like, you know, the reality of when a child comes out to a parent. I think most parents of gay or bisexual or transgendered children would tell you, aspect of my child's life, you know?
I'm sorry, I was just laughing because you said most children would tell you, and then froze, and I was like, and I just laughed. And so what did you say after? What?
I hope the video comes out. Most parents of bisexual, gay, or transgendered kids would tell you that when their child came out to them, their first reaction was, wow, I can't believe I didn't know this side of my child. You know, whether that be surprise or disappointment or in themselves, usually more than the children. And that's sort of what we tried to, you know, write with Lance, a little bit of surprise, but also, you know, a lot of acceptance.
A quick question. You mentioned Diggle. Why do we hear him talk about his wife and child more than we ever see his wife and child? Like, even when he goes home to an empty house.
To be honest with you, there are economic considerations. I would have to get into a long, protracted discussion of the differences between series regulars and recurring characters and the impact that has on the budget. By the way, I'm not talking about anything that's not a reality for every other TV show in the history of anything. But some shows have more money than other shows. Like, you know, I'll give you an example. Sons of Anarchy. God, I'm forgetting her name. There was a show. Sons of Anarchy killed off a character, and the next episode began in the aftermath of the character's death. And there's the actress who's lying on the ground. She's dead. She does absolutely nothing for the entire episode, except just lie there in that one opening scene. And the producer in me went, wow, it must have been really nice to have the kind of money that you need to basically pay an actor their full freight to come and be in one scene where they're dead. I mean, that's that's something that, quite frankly, we can't afford to do on Arrow. You know, we did it with 302 of Arrow, where we had where Sarah was dead, but that was like we had to pay that money, and it was we had to find that meant we had to find the money in other places. I'm giving you like sort of very how the sausage gets made kind of anecdotes, but the reality is that, you know, actors don't work for free, and you know, sometimes we'll save a penny by having him go, you know, having Diggle go home to an empty house.
Well, and I'm glad you mentioned that, because I was going to ask you, and now I'm going to ask you now, about with the interconnected natures of these shows. Arrow is connected to Flash, and the two shows are connected to Legends of Tomorrow, and people are hoping that they'll connect to Supergirl at some point. People are hoping that Constantine will reappear after this season, if that's possible. But what are the drawbacks to the interconnected nature of these shows? I mean, I'm thinking that scheduling the actors. Of course, we haven't seen but we haven't seen Legends yet, so don't know exactly what the interconnection will be. But scheduling the actors and dealing with their agents has got to be a real pain in the ass, because you sign someone up for a season, you say, okay, you're going to be Emily Bett Rickards, you're going to be in 23, 22. Episodes of The Arrow. Oh, by the way, now you're going to be in 6 or 10 episodes of Legends. Or we don't know exactly how it's going to work, but
well, I will say the scheduling has been the much bigger headache than dealing with the agents and managers. The scheduling is really, really hard and requires an enormous amount of creativity on the part of us, the producers, and the assistant directors on the various shows who handle scheduling. Not easy. Not easy at all. And it's not easy on the actors, who oftentimes have to run from one set to the other. I'm not going to lie to you, it's really difficult. And, you know, we're all now sort of on the opposite side of it. We're all, you know, recovering essentially from the scheduling mishigas. We're still actually trying to catch various things up. It starts to get some very technical, you know, scheduling issues that would be really, really boring and hard for me to explain. But we're still not, my point is, we're still not done. You know, even though we're done with the crossovers, we're still dealing with some of the scheduling fallout. It's hard. That said, we really do it because the end result is so worthwhile. You know, I spent my birthday in Vancouver, away from my family, working till midnight along with everybody else with schedules for Flash and Legends and Arrow all in front of us, all juggling things around. That was not how I wanted to spend my birthday, but the end result is awesome. As I was saying to the Arrow crew yesterday, you know, a quadruple axle is far more impressive than a double axle. And one of the reasons why it's so much more impressive is everyone knows it's so much more difficult. And I think when people are going to watch the 4 hours of television that I think is gonna blow their minds, because it's never been done before. We are crossing over Arrow and Flash with characters who then go on to appear in a two-part or two-hour, I don't know how they're gonna broadcast it, pilot of Legends. And this was all filmed basically all at the same time. So it all had to be written at the same time, and each piece had to fit narratively together, and it had to be scheduled at the same time, and it's the end result, because I've now seen it, is spectacular, and really, really, really cool. But it wasn't easy. It was hard to do.
And thank you for using Terry Hatcher's line from Seinfeld to describe her breasts to describe your new show. That's terrific. Here's a question for you. So in the last couple seasons, Arrow and Flash have introduced – well, Arrow introduced Flash, and the two shows have introduced all these new characters, and people have become heroes. Even my wife asked me if Felicity is going to become officially the Oracle, because – you know. And so my question is this, though. A lot of these characters are moving over to Legends, and we'll see them on a more recurring basis. Is that going to open up the opportunity for Flash and Arrow to continue to bring on more DC characters, or is there going to be a pullback of that?
You know, I mean, we've always approached it from a standpoint of story first. Like, you know, like on Arrow, we never made a list of characters like, okay, we got to get in this person, we got to get in this person, we got to get in this person. It was always like, what serviced Arrow, you know? And Legends really came about because the same thing was happening on Flash, and just we sort of looked around and went, wait a minute, we got Victor Garber and Wentworth Miller and Brandon Routh and Katie Lotz, and it was like, wow, that's, if you could get all them to be on a show, that's a very deep bench. It wasn't like, okay, we've got enough people, let's go make a show. In fact, this year on Arrow, one of the things that Wendy Miracle and I sort of very, you know, consciously decided to do was not introduce too many new characters. We felt like we had enough characters in our pantheon after three seasons of Arrow to tell enough story. We didn't feel like we had to bring in someone new. You know, the only exception really was Echo Kellum, who played Curtis Holt. You know, we felt like, okay, with the absence of Ray Palmer, we were going to miss what we had come to really enjoy, which was someone of Felicity's intellectual equivalent at, you know, at Palmer Tech with her. And we also wanted to, you know, bring back some more diversity to the show. We had lost the Yamashiros in season three. You know, we had lost, you know, Colin Salmon as Walter, Roger Cross as Hilton. We wanted to bring some diversity back to the show. We wanted to inject some levity into the show in keeping with season four's lighter tone. You know, but we didn't have to say, oh, that character is Mr. Terrific, you know, but it was, you know, it was sort of out there for the taking, so we did. But that's the thing. It's the superhero consideration is really last. And as you'll see, you know, Echo's character hasn't become Mr. Terrific yet. So we, you know, there's always this opportunity for Flash and Arrow to be sort of a feeder to Legends. But it's by no, it's an organic opportunity. It's by no means something we feel burdened by, like, okay, gotta bring in this character, gotta bring in that character, gotta move him off to Legends. It's an assembly line. Let's go. It's happened. We've been very lucky that it's happened organically, and we'd be crazy to change that up.
All right, we're going to run out of time, so I want to ask you some very fast questions, short answers.
I like fast questions. Okay.
A lot of excitement over Constantine coming in for an episode. I know you've made clear it was one shot for now. Is it possible after this season that he could be seen again?
You know, honestly, it is so not up to me.
Okay.
You know, it's just so that those decisions get made so far above my head or Greg Berlanti's head that I've been told this is a one-off, and we were very happy to do it. And, you know, it's one of the, I think, the cooler things we've ever done on the show.
It was a spectacular one-off. I didn't watch any of the Constantine episodes on NBC, and I was very curious to watch this, and I went, wow, that was cool. All right, another question. Overwatch sequel?
Eventually, it'll be called Overkill, and I really just need to find the time. That's my biggest challenge, because the truth of the matter is just that I had to, you know, I wrote Overwatch over the course of like over two years, and you know, I had to basically take a break from all my comic book work, you know, to create up that space. I just need to find the time for it. Obviously, writing a novel is a much, you know, it's the biggest time commitment you can make to any kind of project. So I have a whole series of notes. I haven't broken out the story yet, but I have a whole series of notes written out about sort of what happens and what the book's about. And thank you for asking.
Well, of course. I got one more, and then we'll wrap up. Are there feature films in your near future as well?
There are. There are two on my desk at the moment. They're both in the I'm rewriting stage. I'm you know, basically finishing up revised drafts of both, and I'm really excited about them. They're both very different, but they've also both come together very, very nicely. And ironically or coincidentally, they're both book adaptations, which is their own interesting, little puzzle. But a great deal of fun, and my hope is to deliver both final enough, you know, or next drafts to the studio by Thanksgiving, to the studio by Thanksgiving, and then we'll see what happens if they have a future beyond beyond those drafts.
Cool. Well, folks, listen, you can find Mark Guggenheim's multiple comic book series at great comic book stores everywhere. Don't know where to find one near you? Go to comicbooklocator.com or call 1-888, that's 38888 comic book, and someone will help you. And, of course, keep watching Arrow every Wednesday night at 8 on the CW. Do we know day and time for Legends?
No, not yet.
I don't think so. Okay.
I know what day and time I want, but we don't know officially yet.
Got it. Would you like them bookended with one of the other shows, or would you want them on a separate day?
I think they would have to be on a separate day for me, but... you know, the beauty part of my job is there are certain things I get a chance to go, you know what, that's your call. I got enough decisions to make. By the end of the day, I've got such decision fatigue. And the network has some very, very smart people being paid a lot of money to make those types of decisions. And it's like, please go with God.
Got it.
Tell us when we're on.
All right. Well, you can follow Mark all over social media, Facebook, Tumblr, Twitter, you name it, he's there. And Mark Guggenheim, great to see you again.
Great to see
you,
too.
Thank you so much for joining us on Mr. Media today.
Thanks again. It's a lot of fun. Awesome.
All right.
Woo!
Mr. Media is recorded live before a studio audience of Olicity shippers who won't be happy until they're sitting in a tree, K-I-S-S-I-N-G, in the new media capital of the world, St. Petersburg, Florida.
To erase my board a little bit.
I see that.
I thought I had erased enough, but I didn't realize how much it would. How much it would get. I mean, I don't think there's anything spoilery on it, but.
All right. I'm not looking at it. I'm just making sure my sound is set up.
You're gonna be crafty. There we go.